No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. We're lucky today that we have a special guest, Robert P. Jones, who is the president and founder of Public Religion Research Institute. He is a leading scholar and an author of the New York Times bestseller, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future, as well as White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in America and American Christianity, which won a 2021 American Book Award. He is also the author of The End of White Christian America, which won a 2019 Grammer Award in Religion. So we're so excited to have you. I would go over his biography and give you his resume and his education, but it's so extensive that we wouldn't be able to have any show if we did that. Thank you so much for being on the show. Mr. Jones, it's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thanks, Senator Brown. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Talk to me about what white Christian nationalism looks like today. We've seen it on the rise. We've seen people talk about it all over the place. But what does it look like from where you stand?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's important just to get a very simple definition out. I mean, it really is this claim, you know, that this country is of, by, and for Christians of European descent. And this idea, you know, has really been with us and dogging our countries since before it was a country, really. And so it really is that claim. You know, we saw this most vividly in our neighborhood on January 6, 2021 at the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And there's a whole, you know, cache of images now of, you know, not just the kind of, pro-Trump signs, but crosses, Bibles, Jesus, you know, is my savior, Trump is my president, shofars being blown, prayers being prayed. Like it was this, kind of claiming of the country for predominantly white Christians in the country who were supporters of Donald Trump.
Well, you know, now I've read the Bible because I'm a Christian. And when I was in college, I had a friend challenge me to read the Bible, say, look, if you're going to study politics, you need to understand this book that has shaped so much politics in the world. So I read it. And I don't remember anywhere where Jesus stormed anything. You know, I mean, I don't get the connection that they make between hate and Christianity or, you know. And as I told you when we started the show, my first job in politics was working for Jimmy Carter. This is a man, we just had somebody on the show last year who went to his Sunday school class. He's still teaching Sunday school and he was attacked by people like Jerry Falwell and others back in the day for being non-Christian. And I never understood that. So how do they make this connection between an entity that said, you know, he who hath no sin cast the first stone, don't judge others, be about love and acceptance. How do they make the connection between that and a guy who says, I am your retribution?
Well, I mean, you know, it's I think we're saying that there's, you know, that is certainly one stream of Christianity that you're describing, you know, and one that I think Jimmy Carter embodied, you know, quite well. And, you know, if you kind of think about the kind of contrasting the spirit, the character of Carter with the spirit, the character of Trump, I mean, there's really just no, you know, comparison there. But, you know, I think it's important to say that there is a different stream of Christianity that's always been wrapped up in white supremacy. And that's kind of a lot of, you know, what I spent the last 10 years of, you know, my life writing about and doing research about it. And that entanglement of white supremacy and Christianity in this country has had this violent strain to it. It has been this, you know, kind of claiming of the space, right, for Europeans of Christian descent. And, you know, in the most recent book, I mean, I trace this back because I really wanted to know how far back it goes. And really, it goes quite back quite far to European roots. And I trace it back to this thing called the Doctrine of Discovery that's really the beginning of the whole colonial project, right? And so, we all learned about Christopher Columbus and, you know, that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But we didn't learn about what happened in 1493, or at least I didn't. And I have a PhD in religion. And I didn't really get, you know, a lot of this, but you know, it's important. In 1493, what happens is that Columbus goes back to Spain and he asks for a number of things. He asks for more ships, more supplies, more soldiers, more missionaries and priests. And then he also asks for a kind of moral mandate. And he asks for that from the church, from the Western European church. At the time, this is before the Protestant Catholic split or the Church of England. So all of Western Europe is under the authority of the Pope in Rome. And he gets this permission and these series of edicts, papal bulls, that came to be known as the Doctrine of Discovery. And they essentially give permission for European Christians in the name of really white supremacy and Christian supremacy, permission to occupy the land, steal the goods, and if needed, kill people in the name of Christianity and claiming these lands. And of course, that's exactly what happened with the indigenous people who were here, with enslaved Africans who were kidnapped and imported to be free labor in this country. And all of that, I think we forget, was done very much in the name of a different kind of Christianity. And so I think it's important to say we've got, you know, more than one strain of Christianity in the country, and the current versions of Christian nationalism that we're seeing active, particularly, I think, in the kind of adherents of the MAGA movement and supporters of Trump, the hardest core supporters of Trump, are drawing on a very long Christian tradition that's rooted in white supremacy and dominance.
Well, you know, why is it, you know, I guess it still baffles me because my understanding, and I do not have a PhD in religion, so you understand it much better than I do, but my understanding was a bunch of people came to Plymouth Rock who were driven out of England because of their religion, and that when they set up the country, Jefferson and the boys, understanding the power of religion, set up a government where there was a clear separation between church and state. But my understanding of the new Christianity that you talk about, or the Christianity you talk about, is they don't believe in the separation of church and state. They believe that the government should embody all the principles of Christianity. Is that right?
It, that is right, and this has been a long kind of history here. But it's notable that Speaker Mike Johnson, for example, is on record saying that he thinks the separation between church and state is a myth, and he's following these kind of pseudo historians in this kind of white evangelical Christian tradition that have been kind of building this. This case, and in many cases based on pure fabrications of quotations that don't exist, et cetera. But nonetheless, it's gotten quite a hold there. And, you know, the you asked about Christian nationalism earlier on. So we at PRI did a survey last year with the Brookings Institution. We were really trying to get at, like, so how many people actually believe these kinds of things? And so we asked questions like, you know, the U.S. should declare itself a Christian nation. or U.S. laws should be based on the Bible. It's important to be Christian, to be truly American, like those kinds of claims. And it's notable that among white evangelicals, again, that kind of core support of former President Trump's base, about two-thirds of them are fully into that world and are either sympathetic or adherents to full adherence of those sentiments, and so are a majority of Republicans today. So this view that is only active in about 3 in 10 Americans overall. So by 2 to 1, Americans reject this worldview, but it has become to be the majority view among Republicans, and particularly among that kind of base of the Republican Party of white evangelical Protestants.
And is it based on we love Jesus, or is it based on we don't like black people and immigrants and other people like that? I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but is it more about white supremacy, or is it more about religion? Or can't they separate the two? Are the two inextricably combined?
Yeah, well, the last book that I wrote in 2020 was called White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And that was one of the key questions in that book, is how entangled is this, particularly in white Christian churches? And the answer is that white supremacy is quite enmeshed in white Christianity in this country. And, that may sound shocking, I think, to hear for many people right off the bat, but if we take even a half step back, and we think, okay, well, how did we get things like Jim Crow segregation, right, all across the South in the most religiously active area of the country? Well, the only way you get that is if if white supremacy is in circulation and, in fact, has enmeshed itself in the DNA of religion in the South, which kind of gives those laws their kind of moral credibility. This is what Martin Luther King, right, was musing about in a letter from Birmingham jail. Here he is in Birmingham, and he's looking around at, all of these fancy churches with their tall spires in Birmingham on every other corner, and he says, like, who are these people, and who is their God, he even asks, right, given that they're supporting segregation and white supremacy. And he has this phrase that has really stayed with me. He says, who are these people? Who is their God? Who are sitting safely behind the anesthetizing power of stained glass windows? And I could tell you, as someone who grew up in Mississippi as a Southern Baptist, I grew up in Jackson in the Southern Baptist Church, and that's absolutely accurate. I would say that, like, it in my own upbringing, being at church really had more of a function of dulling my conscience with regard to racial justice issues rather than enlivening it.
Well, I feel the same way. And I was brought up in the Catholic Church in an Italian neighborhood. Everybody, when I grew up in my neighborhood, everybody was Catholic. They were either Irish, Italian, German, but they were all Catholic. There was nothing but Catholic churches. I thought bagels, we had a bakery in the neighborhood. I thought bagels were an Italian thing because I never, and the first time I ran into a Jewish, grew up and started working in a Jewish clothing store, and people were bringing in bagels and told me they were Jewish. I'm like, what? Get out of here. But anyway, I used to call it the soul wash. Because we go in, we drone in. It was the same thing. We sit there, and the mask was in Latin, so we didn't even understand it. Mm-hmm. And we go Domino's, Nabisco, et tu spearmint gum. We make these things up, and then we go out, and people would scream at each other in the parking lot. All the brotherhood they talk about in church, they go out in the parking lot and they scream at each other, move your damn car. Hey, what are you doing? We had a little parking lot with a single driveway. So I used to call it the soul wash. I'd say we go in once a week. We wash our souls. It's nice to be Catholic because you get forgiven of everything if you go to confession, But that was it. It was all rodent, and I never got anything out of it as a child. It wasn't until I was older and joined a small church, which was all about communion and being with people. And even then, we had to deal with white supremacy. We had to deal with people that didn't want gay people in our church, for example. So I see where there's always been a thread of that in Christianity.
Well, it is notable. I think you're right to point out it's not just an evangelical Protestant problem. You know, like even in New York, you know, which we tend to think of as, you know, this great melting pot and all that stuff and lots of plural respect for pluralism and diversity. But, you know, even in New York churches, you know, were highly segregated. Catholic churches were highly segregated. And even where they allowed African-Americans to attend, they often were forced to receive the Eucharist last. After all the white people, had come up to receive the Eucharist. And, you know, that practice went on, you know, well into the 20th century, you know, even again in kind of a, you know, more northeastern city like New York.
And I could see that sentiment still exists. I even went to a funeral not long ago where the priest stood in front of the church and said, if you're Catholic and you've prepared yourself, you can come up and receive communion. If you're not, you can just sit there and stare at each other. You know, basically, we were shocked. We were like, what? But anyway, there's still a lot of that there. But let me ask you something. What about the environment? Because we see this around the world, right? There's a guy in India named Modi who runs, you know, Prime Minister of India, and he wants to turn the whole government into a religious government. We've seen this in other places too. Is there something in the environment that is making the rise of Christian nationalism more evident now, more popular now, more is something different that we're seeing?
Well, you know, I think you're right to point to, you know, the challenges of, you know, that the Hindu nationalism, right?
And
in our country, it's Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. And I think there is this temptation of, religion's a powerful kind of marker of identity. And it often gets commandeered and used, I think, in political ways. And I think, in our country, because Christianity has been the dominant religion, it's most often been Christianity that has been used that way. And, you know, and here I think it also has this, you know, I'm not a international scholar, so I'm less about the Indian context, but, you know, here it has always been fused with, you know, kind of patriotism, who's really an American, and race. So it has this kind of, to be really American, you have to be, you know, white and Christian. And, you know, it's notable too. I mean, you mentioned like, you know, other ethnicities. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Jews, Italians were not considered white, right? In this country, right? They were considered non-white. Even had to register separately on the census on immigration forms. You know, my wife's family is Jewish, and we've got copies of their immigration forms where they have to check Hebrew. Actually, was the category. To be checked on immigration forms. So, but I think it's because, you know, sort of identity linked to nationalism, you know, as a kind of powerful rallying point, that religious identity is something that can be used as a powerful tool for propaganda and really for marshaling a kind of othering, right, an us and them mentality.
Well, and, you know, I hand it to the founding fathers for setting up a government that wanted separation of church and state because they were all Christians. I just finished reading the Jefferson Bible. You know, Jefferson was such a scholar, religious scholar, that people from all around the world corresponded with him. You know, religious leaders from all over the world corresponded with him when he left office, and he wrote a thing. He wrote a book, which we refer to as the Jefferson Bible, and it's just what he thought was important in the New Testament. He translated it in several different languages. But, you know, I hand it to him for being such a religious person, but understanding the power that it had in politics, right?
Yeah.
Karl Marx calls it the opiate of the masses, you know, because if God says it's true, it doesn't matter what you think. If you think God said it, it doesn't matter, right? Because God said it, it must be true. So it's kind of the ultimate tautology. And let me ask you, your wife's family's Jewish. What about the rise in anti-Semitism lately? Is that connected to this movement, or is it connected to world events?
I think it's absolutely connected to this movement in the U.S. It always has been. I think we often forget, that like we've had previous incarnations of these kinds of Christian nationalist movements.
Yeah.
In the early part of the 20th century, it marched under the banner of the KKK. And now a lot of people don't think about the KKK as a kind of religious movement, but there's plenty of documentation, right, that they weren't just a kind of, ethnic, whites-only anti-black group. Of course, they were that. But if you read their literature, in order to be a member, you had to be not only white, kind of claim some kind of European descent, but you had to be Protestant and Christian. Right. Yeah. That was their positive view. It was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant view of America. And that's why they were anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that Jews have always been, from that point of view, suspect. Right. If you take the fact that, only real Americans and only trustworthy Americans are white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Christians. Then Jews, Catholics, Hindus, Muslims, everyone else is suspect, right? And not really a first-class citizen. I think we're still struggling with those kinds of assertions in today's politics.
Yeah, I think we are too. And that's another thing. Of course, we can't resolve this in 55 minutes on my show, but it's something that's always troubled me too. I don't understand why Jews have been the scapegoat of the world for the past 2,000 years. It seems like every time there's a problem, Jews become the whipping boy. I've never really understood that. But anyway, especially knowing a lot of Jewish people the way I do, which is that they tend to be very family oriented and very loving and giving. And, they were leaders in the Democratic Party. When I first started in the Democratic Party 40 years ago, there was a great divide between Jews and blacks. And I didn't understand it since many of the people that rode down to Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia were Jews. So, but still, there was this great divide between black people and Jews, and it came to a head actually when Jesse Jackson gave a convention speech and referred to the people of New York as they called New York Hymietown. What can we do about this from a political standpoint? Is there any way that we can combat this feeling that you're the thing that intrigued me most about you is that you have in the title of your book Coming Together in the Future. How do we do that? We really have to do that, right? We've all agreed to be in a democracy, so we need to deal with these people. We can't just, like, they blow us off. We can't just blow them off. We can't say, well, half of the country did stand behind this man. So we got to find a way to deal with them. So how do we deal with them?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing to remember is that even though our partisan divides, if you only look at presidential elections, it does look like, a closely divided country with half on one side, half on the other. If you dig a little deeper, though, and you really start digging into the kinds of attitudes that we're talking about, right, who really believes that this country is a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians? Who believes that white people today are facing more discrimination than black Americans or others in the country? Who are really making those kinds of claims? It really is. It's not a 50-50 country. It really is more like a one-third, two-thirds country, where so a third of Americans who are doubling down, mostly white, mostly Christian, heavily evangelical, who are kind of doubling down on that view of the country. But it really is most of the country that doesn't share that view at all. Now, it doesn't always fall along partisan lines that way. But I think that should give us some hope. And I think the other thing is that there is still a very big generational break under 50 and over 50, basically. Americans under the age of 50 are far more likely to embrace this pluralistic, inclusive view of the country. Now, I'm not saying like, you know, we just kind of wait around for the clock to run out. I don't like think that is at all. In fact, I think if we do that, we may not have much left. We'll be standing in some rubble if we wait to do that. But in the book, so yeah, the second half of the title is A Path to a Shared American Future. And I begin to look kind of beyond the headlines and beyond, the national politics and say, well, what's actually happening on the ground? And like, where are there places and maybe even unexpected places where people are coming together across lines to try to heal these divisions, to try to, and not just kind of not in a facile way or an easy way, but are really trying to reckon with the history honestly, tell the truth, and then kind of work for kind of building a different kind of future together. So in the book, you know, I spent some time in Mississippi, where I'm from. I spent some time in around Tulsa, Oklahoma, and in Minnesota, in Duluth, Minnesota, and tell three different stories of where this is happening. I'll just give you one quick anecdote, and you can tell me how much more you want to talk about this, but I'll go to Mississippi, this is where I'm from. And I spent some time up in the Delta. So, you know, very rural, very poor area of the county, Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, which is where Emmett Till was killed and where his killers were acquitted, in 67 minutes of the murder by an all-white, all-male jury in 1955. And then that story really got buried along with Emmett Till, particularly in the white community, until really very recently. So if you had driven through Tallahatchie County looking for a marker telling the story, any kind of memorial before 2000, there was literally nothing there telling that story on the ground. And over the last 20 years, a group of black and white Mississippians in Tallahatchie County got together and said, you know what, we should, they basically started by saying, we need to tell the truth, and we also need to apologize to the descendants of the Till family, because that's never happened. And they worked very, very hard to come together and actually did that. And I think if we stop and remember that this was it's still a small rural community. Many people live their whole lives there. So these are people who, on the one hand, are descendants of enslaved people, descendants of sharecroppers, and on the other hand, descendants of the kind of white planter class that had enslaved people and exploited sharecroppers in the wake of that. And yet they found a way to kind of stay in the room together, have some difficult conversations, issue this apology, and then kept going. And in fact, their efforts have just recently resulted in the establishment of a new national monument that President Biden and Kamala Harris announced last summer. It's going to be the Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley National Monument that's going to be jointly in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi, and in Chicago. But that would have never happened had this intrepid group of people not met in the courthouse basement week after week for a couple of decades, really, to lay the groundwork for something like that to be possible.
Well, and is that what we need to do? Is that really a kind of prescriptive advice for the future? Because I think that is a real problem. I think we need to get people together and look at our commonalities. You know, we all love our children. We all want the best for them. There are many things that we have in common. I've heard the story you just told about the Till family. I've heard from other people in other circumstances. We had we have a minister here in Washington who went down to Virginia where Hispanics and blacks were fighting in the pork industry. They were someplace in Virginia, Smithfield, and he went down there and he got these people together. He started inviting them to dinners, and they would sit down with each other, and he would say, "You guys are not the enemy. You're being pitted against one another. The big slaughterhouses and stuff are bringing in immigrants to work, and they're setting you off against each other. But the real problem are the people you work for, not you." So they formed a union, and now, you know, because they had these dinners where they sat and they talked. So is that what we need to do? Are we just as negligent in not reaching out to this community and trying to figure out ways to embrace them and get them to talk to us? Because I think we, as liberals, we feel the same way. We feel that every Trump supporter drives a pickup truck with a gun rack in the back and has a fourth grade education. And that's just not true.
Yeah, I think it's right. You know, we've done some pretty definitive, measures of kind of social isolation along lines of race and religion. And you can see it. It's really stark. I mean, you know, today, for example, your average in the survey, we asked people to tell us about people that were basically in their close friendship networks, like people that they had conversations about important things over the past 12 months is how we described it. So not just acquaintances, but people you actually talk to about what's going on in your life. And when we framed the question that way, we asked them to name up to seven people in their close friendship circles. And then we asked them about their race, their religion, and other kind of attributes about them. And we found that, even though the country is becoming much more diverse, there are kind of neighborhoods aren't formally or legally segregated by race the way they had been in our history. And yet there is still this social segregation that happens just, by the legacy of these structures and that we don't have institutions that naturally bring people together across lines of class or race or religion. We essentially found that today, the average friendship network of white Americans is 91% white, right? Yeah. And 75% of white people have absolutely no person of color at all in their core friendship network. And that's a legacy. That's not just white people being racist. Like that's a legacy of structures, right, that we've all grown up in that tend to kind of put us into these kind of racial categories. It's still true today. Martin Luther King was kind of famously said that 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. And that's still largely true. We've made some progress on that. But today it's still about 85% of churches that are essentially monoracial churches today. So, our schools have taken steps backward, public schools, even though we made some progress up through the 80s, as you well know, that there's been much loss on that front where schools have become resegregated, from the high point in the 80s there. And so what we're lacking, I think, are institutional spaces where people can come together to have honest conversations about what they share in common, even where they disagree, right? But a safe place for honest conversations that can provide a kind of ongoing place for contact where people can kind of get to know each other. So I think, the example you gave of people getting together for dinner over a period of time really matters. And I've got a couple of examples in the last book of some churches that did that. Like in Macon, Georgia, I have one example of a predominantly black and a predominantly white church. They were literally right around the corner from each other. And as far back as in the early 1800s, were actually the same church, right? And where enslaved people were brought to church by enslavers. That's their history. They have this shared history, and yet had by the 20th century had basically just existed in completely separate social spheres. And they finally had two ministers that said, you know what, we literally share kind of some common literal common ground in this park that both of their sanctuaries were adjacent to, and like use that space, right, to have Easter egg rolls, shared dinners after church, like to get to know each other. And that actually began to make a real difference.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it did. And I think we should do more of that. And I should say, everything you're saying here rings so true with me, because I was a hippie that grew up in the 60s and 70s. And I went to a large state university, and we all wanted to love each other and be brothers. But you could walk into the cafeteria, and all the black people were on one side of the cafeteria, and all the white people were on the other side of the cafeteria. Always amazed me. There'd be like one white guy sitting with the black table, and there'd be one black person sitting over with the white people. But for the most part, it was pretty much segregated. And when you go to Europe, for example, you see so many more interracial couples than you see in the United States. Is this, again, tied to our history, that we have this feeling of are our institutions segregating us, or is that something that comes in the philosophy that we've all been brought up with? That, you know, what?
Yeah.
Or are they the same thing? We form the institutions, so it's all tied together.
Yeah, it's like the chicken and egg problem here.
Yeah,
I mean, of course,
exactly.
Yeah, we build these institutions that then turn around and reinforce, this kind of segregation. But it's worth noting that, you know, these were not accidents in American history. I think that's really important to say that these institutions get off the ground with a commitment to white supremacy and a moral justification largely provided by white Christianity. That gave them their power. And I've often said that, you know, if at any point a majority of white Christians opposed white supremacy, they could have ended Jim Crow, they could have ended slavery, like literally overnight. But there were just never quite enough of them in those times to kind of, you know, do it in that way. So there were enough people who were at least willing to turn a blind eye and, you know, and implicitly support it. That kind of, you know, I tell you, like, one example, like, from my own life, that it's not until you kind of, like, start studying this that you really start seeing these very clear examples or even hearing stories. So one story that came out when I was doing my own kind of research about my own sort of family's history and Southern evangelicalism, my family's always been deeply involved in church. And, like, one of the most prized possessions I have, in our kind of family history is an old family Bible that's from 1815 for my mother's side.
Wow.
Of the family, right? So it's deep, deep in our roots. And, you know, I found out through talking to my parents that in the early 1960s, my grandfather was a deacon at a church in Macon, Georgia, and that one of his official roles on a Sunday morning was to essentially be a bouncer on the front steps of the church to make sure that no non-white people entered the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Right, to kind of keep the sanctuary all white. And that wasn't like a wink, wink, nod, nod thing. That was like an official role doled out by the Board of Deacons to somebody every Sunday morning. And it was a role my grandfather, played. And so I think it's just so deep. And I think if you grew up white, it's often hard to see because it's sort of the water you swim in, kind of thing. But I think it has been both, that we're, you know, these institutions got off the ground in very deliberate ways. Then once they're on the ground and they're working, they have a life of their own, and they do reinforce in every new generation the assumptions, right, that were built into the institutions in the first place.
Yeah, and you know, I grew up in a family, like I say, and I lived in a city with the highest black population in America, Newark, New Jersey. Never had a black teacher. Never saw a black fireman, never saw a black police officer. Everybody was white. And, we used to have vigilantes in our neighborhood that if you were an African-American and you got out of the car in my neighborhood, you were either really, really brave or really, really crazy. Because we had these guys, these Italians, we used to call them Goombas, that would roam the neighborhood. And my grandmother would be the first one to tell you that they were bad people. They weren't nice people. But then she would also say, but they keep us safe. She believed that, well, maybe you shouldn't beat up people and throw them out of the neighborhood, but, you know, they served a real purpose in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
good. And that's the scariest thing. I used to say that, you know, people look for evidence to reinforce the way they believe rather than looking for the truth, right? And so my grandmother, I would say, I love my grandmother, make no mistakes, but I could say a black person could give her a kidney and she wouldn't remember that, but she remembered every black person she ever saw cast a welfare check in a liquor store. You know, they look for things that reinforce the way they believe. So how do we get beyond that? Do we just have to evolve out of that? Or is there anything the government can do to facilitate this happening? I mean, we tried things like busing, and they really kind of backfired, didn't they? I mean,
you know, in a way, I mean, I would say yes and no. I mean, there's certainly, you know, but I would say that for me, it made a real difference in my life. I grew up, so I was born in 1968. And so I grew up in elementary school in the 70s and high school in the 80s. And, you know, Mississippi had drug its feet after Brown v. Board of Education and did not integrate the schools till my generation. So the elementary schools in the 70s, I remember getting my first black teachers, my first black classmates, and they were all bused, like, from West Jackson over to Southwest Jackson, where we were on the kind of working class side of town, but the white working class side of town, still very segregated neighborhoods. And, you know, there was like some controversy, but what I remember from what it did for me, though, was up until that point, I mean, I literally had no contact with people on an everyday basis who weren't white. Right. And so that meant that from that point on my soccer team, my baseball team, you know, other kinds of activities, they were integrated, and it really changed my life for the better. You know, so I think it was actually a great success story in that way. And you know, I'd be very different, I think, than I am today had I not had. And it also, I think, exposed fissures in the other elements. So I remember, like, for example, my integrated soccer team wanted to have you know, end of the year swimming party. And we booked it at the Moose Lodge, and they canceled it on us the day before when they found out that we had three black kids on our soccer team, and they weren't going to let us use the pool because they still had rules. This was like 1984, right? Not 1954.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, had I not had an integrated team, an integrated school, that would have just gone right by me as a white kid, like, you know, but because I think it exposed those things and helped me sort of see the white supremacy that was all around me that I think it would have remained invisible otherwise.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And I had a similar experience with, I always considered myself lucky because I had a father who believed that everybody was exactly the same, men, women, didn't matter your race, didn't matter your religion. You had the same amount of smart black people as you had smart white people and good black people as you had good white people. And, you know, everything was the same. And then I had a mother who grew up in a family that believed every stereotype. You know, the Irish were all drunks. Jewish people were all cheap. Black people were all out to steal your money. And, you know, so I got to see both sides of the coin, and yeah, and it really made a difference in me. And I got to say, with my children, it's not that we haven't made progress, because, you know, I like to tell this story all the time, that I brought my son home from soccer practice one time when he was about 12, and he told me about this amazing goal that this kid named Timmy made on the team. And there were two Tims on the team. One was black and one was white. And I said, which one was it? Was it the black kid or the white kid? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know what color he was, but I was like, what? That's the first thing we noticed about people.
Yeah.
First we noticed what sex you were. Then we noticed what color you were, you know? So we have made progress, but let me ask you, how about the displacement of white people? Because my kids, when Donald Trump got elected, my daughter said to me, we're in a lot of trouble, Dad. And I said to them, no, you're in a lot of trouble. I'm a wealthy white guy. I got no trouble. You know, how much of this has been brought on by the fact that wealthy white guys, or white guys in general, have been displaced a little bit in our society to make room for other people? Has that added to all this?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I quite see it that way. I mean, I think that what, you know, there's a couple things that's going on. I mean, there's no doubt that white working class men, you know, are living many living in very challenging circumstances. I mean, the loss of jobs, right? Manufacturing jobs that you can get without a college degree that pay a living wage. I mean, this is a real problem, right? And this sort of idea that, you know, two generations ago, like my grandfather was a sheet metal worker, right? Yep. And made, and his wife didn't work and yep. made enough money, that, you know, they had a small two bedroom brick house, yep. nothing fancy, but, you know, they were homeowners and kind of lower middle class, and, it worked. Right. And I think that that's just not that available. As it has been. So I think that's a real problem, and we shouldn't dismiss, I think, that grievance, right? The sense that even if I play by the rules and I work hard, there's no way I can get ahead. And I think that's a real challenge, you know, for the country to deal with. And that kind of affects people across the board. But I think the kind of expectation that white working class people have had, you know, are a real challenge to deal with. Today, but I do think there is this sense of zero-sum game, right? Also, that I think is playing out here. That you know, if you get something, I lose something. That is not always true. I mean, sometimes that's true, but I think there's just this sense that you know, if the country is becoming more pluralistic, and if African Americans are succeeding or Latinos are succeeding, that means we are losing. I do think there's a kind of mythology around that's pretty corrosive, actually, to kind of our civic fabric, right? Instead of, you know, the story you told about, like, earlier about the union. I mean, I think that's often been a message from unions is, no, like, it's not that if Latinos get a job, white people don't, or black people get a job, Latinos don't. It's that the pie can be bigger, really, you know, if we organize together, right, and we don't have to be pitted against each other. So I think that's also a challenge, is to kind of get beyond the zero-sum game mentality and realizing, like, oh, actually, we have some common cause here that could lead us to kind of bond together and, you know, make the pie actually bigger for all of us.
Well, again, I've tended to be a civil rights activist because I moved to Montgomery County, Maryland from North New Jersey. Bad little Italian neighborhood in North New Jersey. My family moved to Montgomery County, and then both my parents died. And I was an orphan. I was an orphan as a teenager. And you know what? I lived in white, suburban Montgomery County. There were people that rushed in to help me. There were people that really saved me. I was ready to throw my life away as a teenager. And I often thought when I would go back to North New Jersey, how different things would have been if I lived there. You know, I often said, when people talk about having an advantage as a white person, I really, really got a good share of that. And if I had lived in a less conducive environment for white people, that wouldn't have happened. And so that's always been my quest, is to try to make that happen for everybody. It shouldn't be that way, right? It shouldn't be that way. You shouldn't be have a better community. Again, is there anything we can do as a politician? Is there anything I can do to help bridge this gap and give us a future? What is our future? What do you see as our future?
Well, I hope we live into this. You know, I said, I think we've got two traditions struggling with each other. Again, this kind of, are we a white Christian America? It's kind of a promised land for European Christians, or are we a pluralistic democracy? And I think we're being tested again, as we often are. Every generation has to, you know, answer this question and put our marker down we're a pluralistic democracy. We're going to work to make that a reality. And we're going to resist the forces that try to take us down this other road. But I do think, the thing I have learned is that I do think these kind of local things, whether it's the union example you gave, the church examples I gave, or the Emmett Till Interpretive or Emmett Till Memorial Commission example. I also talk about in the book, examples of a group of interracial group that got together in Duluth, right? And the same thing happened in Tulsa to try to tell the truth about our history as a way of building a better future together. And I think the thing that happens about those local things, whether it's labor unions or churches or civic groups organizing to do something like apologize for a past injustice, is that it does knit people together in the places where they live, right? These are people they're going to run into in the grocery store or at the school board meeting or at a PTA event. And there is a kind of social fabric that holds it together, and I think it gives people more accountability. And so, I think that if we can let 1,000 of those flowers bloom or more, that's what's going to start giving us, kind of sturdier social fabric that we can build up from. I don't think we're going to do it at the national political level, or certainly not the partisan level. But I think these things can be a real source of strength for American democracy.
Well, and my personal opinion is we also have to change the narrative about each other. You know, one thing that really made an impression on me is that my mother worked in a black school, an all black school, and they loved my mother. The kids loved my mother and she loved the students, but she believed every stereotype about black people. And I used to say to her, "Mom, what do you think happens to them when they turn 18? You think they turn into something different than the kids you love?" But I realized after a while the difference for her is when she looked at them in school, she was in a middle school, she didn't see black people, she saw children. And that was a difference for her because she was a universal mother. She loved kids. And so I've always thought we need to change the images we see of each other. You know, we need to see the people. We need to see the children. We need to, relate on that level. But that's just my personal little pitch for bringing people together. I'm not exactly sure how we do that.
I'll just add one quick thing to that.
Yeah.
Because I think you're right on. And, the other thing that I think has been so corrosive with, the way that the national political scene, and particularly I think the kind of gasoline that Donald Trump has poured on the fire, is this conceptualization of our, people with whom we disagree politically. I think that Trump has kind of encouraged his followers to stop thinking about people who disagree with them as fellow citizens with differences of opinion, right? Instead, they are in collusion literally with the devil. Like they are operating, they're kind of agents of evil who are threats to the country. And I think when we think about, political contests like that, there's nothing more corrosive to democracy, right? Because then you assume people are acting not only in bad faith, but that people are acting in ways that are out to, destroy you and the country. And that's really hard to recover from, in a democracy.
Well, I think that's a really important point, and we're running out of time, so I want to ask you two things. One, I assume people can get your books anywhere, and number two, do you have a website that you want to give to people in case they want to? Yeah, go ahead. Please do that, because I'd like people to reach out to you.
That's great. No, so the book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future, is available audiobook. Ebook, hardcover right now. Paperback will be out in September, but available wherever books are sold. It is actually half price right now on Amazon. And then the other thing to say is I do write a weekly Substack newsletter, and it is at www.whitetoolong.net. So if you want to kind of hear from me and ongoing thoughts about the kinds of things we've been talking about, you can find it there. And PRRI's research is at PRRI.org.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I encourage everybody that's listening to either listen to the podcast or tune into the website or get engaged somehow, because I think that's how we end all this, is that we can all get engaged. But Robert P. Jones, thank you so much for being on the show. We hope to have you back again sometime so we can talk about how much the internet has caused, because I don't care what your crazy idea is, there's always somebody on the internet that agrees with you. So I don't know how much that has stirred this stuff, but that's a discussion for another day. Thank you so much, folks. We always leave you with the song. We dedicate this to Mr. Jones, who was kind enough to be with us today. Thanks, and see you next week. And thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.